It's again another privilege of mine to introduce Professor B.V. Srikanthan, former director of the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, and now Raman, is it? No. Ramanujan Professor of Ramanujan Professor, Professorship, holder of the Ramanujan Professorship, also working at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research. The Ramanujan Professorship is given by the Indian National Science Academy for very distinguished people in this, working in the subject. Now, Professor Srikanthan is a very old friend of mine. I think one day you will say, there's already nepotism in this institute, in the center, because they are all old friends of mine. It merely tells you that the people belonging to this age group knew each other well, coordinated with one another, so whatever their profession, we seem to know each other. Of course, I'm an ex-Tata Institute man, and Srikanthan joined 1 year earlier than me, but he started as a student and I was on the staff. So there's a slight difference which I'd like to maintain. But beyond that, he's gone way ahead of me in many ways, and his contributions in cosmic rays and particle physics are known all over the world. And besides that, he's an experimental physicist whom I like. He measures things and then makes his theories. Doesn't make his theories and then measure, ask other people to measure things for him. And he was responsible for many instrumentation activities in the old Tata Institute at the Yacht Club and then later on at the at Colaba. And anybody who's built instruments on his own automatically gets the sort of value of the measurement that he has done, and that intensive thinking really helps you to project your ideas in a more satisfactory way than simply working on theory. But anyway, it's good to have with us such a distinguished physicist as Professor Srikanthan. In recent times he's been working on cosmological problems, particularly the Big Bang and the consequences from his knowledge of particle physics. So what is interesting now seems to be the first few seconds or even less than that after the so-called creation, whoever said it's time for the creation, it's time zero. He had some very complicated phenomena suddenly operating and people are trying to work backwards. Unfortunately, though he's an experimental physicist, he can't do much experiments on this particular event because it happened. How many billion years ago is
20,
it? 20 now, from 40 to 20. It happened 20 billion years ago, and he's got to make conjectures of the existing physical phenomena and then tying up various things using modern theory, relativity and such. But the progress that has been made in the last few years is nothing short of being termed as really fantastic. Perhaps even more fantastic than what the molecular people do in biology, because that's been going on for the last 200 years. But this subject is a very fresh one. It's barely, 10 years old?
Well, you know, it's an old subject which has revived.
But using particle physics in cosmology is more recent. And so we are greatly looking forward to the talk on. It is I who asked him to speak on this subject. I don't know whether he thinks it's an appropriate subject. It must be because he has agreed to it. And called physical creation as opposed to divine creation. You know, people get mixed up with the two things.
I wonder.
So, I now leave the floor to Professor Srikanthan.
Some people want to know whether Professor is from the
No, he's from Bangalore, Manchester
College.
There's a vested interest here, you know. But he's in. Professor, you will be my
Yeah.
We are recording it now.
Well, it's always a great pleasure for me to do anything that Dr. Ramana asked me to do, because he always chooses the right things to be done at the right time. So when I got a letter from him that I should speak about physical creation, I was too happy to do it. Of course, I am, as he said, more of an experimentalist, and physical creation is one of those subjects in which I'm very much interested, but not one of my very special subjects. But it led me, this particular assignment, as I would say, led me to think quite deeply as to how to present the facts that we know in science to persons who are not very familiar with all the developments of and the sophistications of modern science and technology, because he also had sent me the people who will be attending this particular course, because their backgrounds are very different from the normal audience to which we talk about in terms of such problems. So let me see whether my experiment is successful or not, because I have tried to make it understandable by people who are intelligent, not necessarily with a good scientific background. Now, creation has essentially three aspects. There is creation by man, then creation by animals, and creation by nature. We essentially call creation by nature as physical creation for reasons which we shall see. It is the hope of the scientists, particularly the biologists, that both the man and the animal are nothing other than a physical system, and so every creation just comes under creation by nature. But we will not pursue that line just now, because we want to talk more about what we know today rather than what one hopes for. Now, creation by man, you know, can also be classified into different types. There is the creations like art, sculpture, painting, music, drama, poetry. All this is comes under creation. You call a person highly creative if he indulges in these activities like music, drama, poetry. I mean, you can name very great names who are great creators in this. Then again, creation also, when if you go to history, especially of the development of human thought, logic has been a very important creation by man. Then mathematics is another creation by man. And then lot of theory in various fields. And then, of course, philosophy. Then in the last 300, 400 years, we can say, there is another creation, which is science. And of course, science and technology and engineering all go together. Science, medicine, engineering, technology is another type of creation by man. Now, these creations, I want to underline this, if you take the first one, art, sculpture, etc., has an emotional appeal, inspires, touches the soul, and it creates happiness, joy, and so on. That's the motivation for it. There's a motivation why one should indulge in that kind of creation. And if you come to the next one, logic, mathematics, and so on, then they're all intellectual pursuits. There is a purpose. I mean, if you pursue that, you try to discern a purpose in everything that you see. And then, of course, connections between time and space, past and present, all these come under logic, mathematics, philosophy, and so on. When you come to the last one, that is science, technology, medicine, etc., you immediately see they have utilitarian aspects, human necessities, control over nature, quality of improvement of quality of life. These are the main things that motivate us. Of course, some of us do it just for a better understanding of nature. That becomes pure science. But there's a great motivation for doing creative science, essentially because of the purpose it serves. In all this creation by man, there is a plan, which we can see. There is a purpose and a goal. And materials are derived from nature, are suitably transformed. You don't create materials, but you take what is available in nature, transform it, and use it. Of course, as time goes on, we are making increasing use of science and technology for the purpose of whatever we create, whether we create a Boeing aircraft or a ship or a building, we are making use of the technology that is advancing. Now, in contrast to this, let us go down and see the creation by animals. Now, creation by animals has always been a puzzle. For example, you take a spider's web. It's a beautiful creation, and it is very symmetric. There's a lot of things about it. But why does it do? Is there a plan? All that we can say is the purpose is only maybe to catch some insects and survival. But still, we don't know why. It again, there is a certain amount of why that particular pattern is there, and every spider more or less does the same thing. So these are aspects which we don't understand. The same thing is true of all these things. If you see, bird builds a nest essentially for survival of its young ones, and then beehive is again, there's a purpose for it, kind of thing. But here we tend to say that there is no plan. But probably we brush it under the word instinct, that all these animals have an instinct. And on the basis of that, they are able to do all these things. They may, at least these are animals for which we don't create any brain. So there is no question of any thinking, any planning, and things like that. It happens. For example, an anthill. But one important thing we notice, however, is that here it is collective effort. So the question is, without planning, without how a collective effort takes place, is a mystery still. And again, here also the requisite material you pick up from nature. What I'm emphasizing is the rest of my talk is all about how all this material is created. But here again, nature has provided you with the material. The animals also pick up the material that is available around us, and then they create whatever they want to do. Now we come to the main topic, that is physical creation. What do we mean by physical creation? Is spontaneous creation independent of the influence of a creator? That is the basic. A scientist will define creation as a physical creation when you can't find a creator behind the whole thing, either a man or an animal or God, whatever it is. Then only you call it a spontaneous creation or a physical creation, because that is the domain of all the scientific laws, physical laws, and so on. Now, physical creation, you need certain basic things. You need certain concepts, which we are all familiar with. You need space, you need time, you need matter, you need energy. For any kind of creation, these are the four basic concepts you need. Then, of course, the scientists will tell you that you have certain forces acting. Creation is always a result of the operation of certain forces like gravitation, electromagnetism, and I'll talk about the other forces in a little while. And then there are also certain important laws of nature. This is very important, as we shall see, like conservation of energy, that you just can't create energy out of nothing. You can only transform one form of energy to another form. The total energy has to be conserved. And then the physical laws have to be universal. You can't have one physical law in Rome, another in Bombay, another in Tokyo. When you do an experiment, whether you do it in Rome or whether you do it in Bombay or whether you do it in Delhi, it must give rise to the same results. That means the forces are not dependent on their locations. The same thing about time also. Whether you do the experiment today or 100 years later or 1,000 years earlier, it should not matter. That means all these is a constancy in the way nature operates, and those laws which have been discerned in the last 300, 400 years. Then we also believe in causality, because we always think that for everything that happens, there must be every effect is the result of some cause. At least this is the belief up to a certain stage. As we shall see, this leads into a lot of problems as we go to very fundamental creations. But mostly all scientific creations, you can always find the relation between the cause and effect, and always the cause precedes in time the effect. And how do you derive all these things? Derived on the basis of our experience and observation and experimentation. That is, you design specific experimentations and then you verify, you make a hypothesis of a law and then you verify whether that law is valid or not. So that's what you call experimentation. And then of course, many times there is insight and the effect of genius, because sometimes these physical laws have become clear to us on the basis of people like Einstein and people who are really genius. In all this, as far as physical creation is concerned, it is always a chance happening. In fact, the entire creation, wherever you talk about creation, if you ask a scientist, he will tell you it is just the coming together of certain constituents and the operation of certain forces, then the thing must happen with a certain probability and it happens. So you call it a creation at any level is essentially a chance happening controlled by certain forces. And we have recognized basically four forces, the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, and the nuclear force, and the weak force, which we'll come to. And then in the last 300 years, one other important development has been, we have recognized that everything we see around us on the earth can be understood in terms of just 92 elements, as compounds made of 92 elements. Whatever you take, you see around you, ultimately if you analyze the chemical composition, it is just one of those elements which you are very familiar with. The interesting thing is that by means of spectroscopic observation of the sun, of the planets, and of the distant stars, etc., the same elements are there, maybe in different proportions, wherever you go in the universe. You don't find elements which are different from what you see. And the properties of these elements are identical. In fact, a very interesting situation is, if you have produced hydrogen on the earth, this hydrogen is the same as the hydrogen that you see on the sun, the same hydrogen that you see in a distant star. That means there is certain universality about the chemical composition of the universe. Now, these 92 elements, though they have very different properties, as you know, sulfur is very different from iron, iron is very different from uranium is radioactive, iron is not. But still, when you analyze them, you find ultimately there is a nucleus of each element. The nucleus consists of just two kinds of particles, the protons and the neutrons, which they have found. The proton is a positively charged particle and a nicovalent particle is there, the neutron. These two bound together form the nuclei. And the difference between one element and another is just in the number of these constituents. And then there are these electrons surrounding these nuclei and which are responsible for, and which make the atom neutral. That means if you have a certain amount of positive charge in the nucleus, the corresponding number of negative charge in the electrons outside, and the atom as a whole is neutral. It is the properties of the electrons in the various orbits that are responsible for different chemical properties. That's also very universal. That means everything that we see ultimately today consists of just these three particles, protons, neutrons and electrons. At least that was the thinking for a long time. Now, let us consider a very simple creation we are all familiar with. Let us take the example of creation of rain. And any schoolboy will tell you that what happens is there is this solar heat coming in, the sun's heat heats up the water in the oceans, then the water vapor goes up, clouds are formed. As you know, the temperature falls as you go up, so there is condensation and then there is gravitational force to bring it down in the form of rain. So the general every step is understood, can be explained in terms of our normal experience if you just take a simple thing like creation of rain. Of course, in that process, we have introduced several things, that is water, we have introduced the atmosphere and the properties of the atmosphere, which have all been analyzed and understood. But here you ask the question that why does it happen? Why does it rain? Is there a purpose behind it? The scientist will cannot give you any reason why it should rain. He says that the physical conditions are there, the sun is there, the atmosphere is there, the water is there, so it must happen. When the proper conditions are there, it must rain. There is no other justification why it should rain. The necessary physical conditions are there, because of that rain takes place. There is no other intervention of any body coming in at all, except the forces which you understand, the gravitational force, the force that evaporates the heat from the sun, and so on. This is very simple. Now we go to the next step and ask the question, all right, I understand the formation of rain, which is very simple. I can explain it in terms of what I know. But how did the waters of the ocean come about? Because we have seen so much of water in the ocean. We should ask that question ourselves. Any child will ask that question. From where did all this water come about? How did the soil get formed? On the earth we see so much of silicate, so much of aluminum, so much of iron, so much of things. We must ask ourselves the question, how did this get formed? It must have got formed some time or the other in the past. How did that happen? Then, related question is, how did the earth itself get formed? And how did the sun get formed? Because sun and earth are related, as we shall see. And as I have written here, these are simple questions that any of us can ask, even a child. But to find the answer is a tall order. And that has been essentially the development of science in the last 300 years. It is once started with simple questions like this, phenomena of lightning, phenomena of rain, thunder, and things like that. Try to understand how this is happening. And gradually, one has come now to a situation where, you see, the whole of creation can be understood. But it has taken 300 to 400 years, and still there are big problems. So let us go back and now try to ask the question, how did water get formed in the oceans, and how did all these various elements, because atmosphere, we know, contains nitrogen, oxygen, and so on. We had to answer how all these constituents got formed. And as I said already, these same elements are there in our nearby other stellar objects like the sun, the planets, and so on. So here we come to the first idea of creation. We assume that somehow all the elements were there. Then it's a very simple thing to work out a theory, because as Dr. Ramana said, in all these things there is no way of verifying these creations. We can only go by arguments and say, and create some laboratory situations where something similar can be created. But we cannot be sure that this is the only way it happened. So in all that I am going to say now, it's a consistency argument only is there. I cannot swear that this is the only way it could have happened. But there are arguments to say that if it had happened in any other way, then we would not have been there to be talking about these things in this way, because this is what they call the anthropic principle, according to which things have happened in a particular way. That is why we are here, and we are able to work backwards and understand them in a particular sequence. So let us assume that there exists a sufficiently large cloud containing the requisite amounts of different elements, because we said the planets, the sun, the earth all have the same elements. So all that we need now is a large cloud which contains all these elements, and then we can work out a scenario by which the sun is formed, the earth is formed, and how the various materials in this get formed, that is the silicates and the water, and so on. Well, that has been worked out. I will not go into the details. There is what happens is, if you have a large cloud, how large the cloud must be? The cloud, to start with, must be something like 10,000 billion miles. 1 billion is, 9 zeros. Instead of writing 9 zeros here, I have put 10,000 and billion. That means 10 1 followed by 13 zeros is the size of the cloud that you need to make the solar system. You start with that kind of a cloud which contains all this matter that you want, that is there, and 90% of it we recognize goes into the sun. And there are arguments to say why it should 90% should go again to the gravitational force and so on. And then when this cloud starts, one of the properties of such clouds is essentially is due to gravitational force, as time progresses, they start compressing. This is a very important result that has been found by experiments. So we assume, do we start with a very large cloud with the requisite types of elements in them, and then it starts compressing, and then you start forming the central region, you form the sun, and then as it compresses, it starts rotating very fast, it becomes a huge cloud which is rotating very fast, and then it breaks up into some kind of rings, and then in each ring there will be clumps of matter, and then they form the various planets. A consistent theory can be worked out on such a basis. That means you start with a very large cloud of the various elements, then you can understand how the sun gets formed out of the same material, how the earth gets formed and so on. But it turns out that there is a big difference between the sun and the earth in terms of the relative composition. The sun is mostly hydrogen and helium. Though it has got all the 92 elements that we see on the earth, it is in a negligible quantity other elements other than hydrogen and helium compared to the earth. This is again connected with the evolution of that cloud as a depends upon the temperature of the interior and so on. But the more interesting thing is, as far as the earth is concerned, it has been possible to work out in sufficiently great detail how the various elements got formed just out of this cloud, how the central portion all became iron, and then heavy elements like gold, because if you take a centrifuge, you see I said that the whole cloud is rotating very fast, then what happens is the heavier elements tend to go inside and the lighter elements will be on the outer side. So it has been possible to completely work out how the composition of the earth with the various elements has been formed. Here an interesting thing is, for example, you take gold. The total amount of gold that is there in the center of the earth in the molten form is estimated that if you take all that gold out, we can solve the problem of the economics of the world, I suppose. If you just take out all that gold, you can coat the entire earth 1 meter thick of gold. That is the amount of gold that is there in the center of the earth in the form of. If you try to mine it, maybe you will get into trouble because of environmental problems and so on. But that tells you that the heavy elements, the iron, gold, and lead, all these things are there right in the center of the earth in much larger quantities than what we see on the surface.
So the sun was at the center of the whole block.
Yeah.
Did it form these heavier elements on the inside?
No, what happens there is, I'll come to that question, the evolution of different types of stars comes to the, and also as a function of temperature. And also the important thing is, while this clouds themselves have got a certain angular momentum, you know, one of the anomalies is that the sun is not such a, sun doesn't carry so much of angular momentum, kind of, it doesn't rotate very fast compared to the other planets around the sun.
In this sense, we are presupposing that the cloud existed and our element existed.
Yeah, I am coming to that. You can now, that's the next question I am going to ask. How did the various elements get formed? But now I am telling you that if you make the assumption that a cloud of this size existed, it is possible with all our knowledge today to give fairly convincing arguments about the various aspects of the materials that we see on the earth, in the planets, and in the sun, and so on. Pardon?
Clumps.
Clumps. Clumps. You see, in these rings, what happens is, as it starts rotating, matter again goes into the form of clumps. And one of the clumps contracts and becomes the earth.
Sir, excuse me, how was this cloud formed?
I'm coming to that. Yes, 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 yes. So, as I was telling you, this is contraction phase of the earth. You see, that's one of the interesting things about, if you start with a large cloud under gravitational effect, the tendency is to contract. And when it contracts, temperature shoots up. And many of the chemical reactions are essentially because the earth becomes a huge furnace where you can cook practically anything you want out of the constituents. And that is the same thing that happens at all levels. It's just a question of higher and higher temperatures and having the right kind of materials. Pardon? I don't understand. You mean
when the cloud was there and with the gravitational it was rotating?
Yeah.
Now when the cloud is there, I presume that it will be in a gaseous state.
Yes, yes.
And when the gaseous state is there, how the gravitational dominates?
No, no, gravitational force you cannot avoid at all. See, in any case, what happens is that any matter attracts any other matter. Now, the question is, statistically, what happens is that the tendency, when you start with any cloud, there is what is known as a fluctuation phenomena. If once, because of fluctuation, you have an increase in density, that becomes the seeding for the contraction. You are perfectly right that if I had a homogeneous material without any fluctuation in density, what you say is perfectly true, that it cannot. But what happens in nature is that fluctuations take place because of the movement of the molecules. You get a certain area where the density increases. Once the density increases, that nucleates the contraction.